The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org. Good evening, and thank you very much for coming. My name is Andy. I'm Director of Author Events here. Before we get started, just the usual reminder to please turn off your cell phones and to refrain from picture taking. I'm going to cheat tonight. Instead of writing an introduction, I'm just going to read a paragraph from the book that I think is particularly apposite given the topic and given where we are this morning. I said this morning, but I meant this evening. The library will endure. It is the universe. As for us, everything has not been written. We are not turning into phantoms. We walk the corridors, searching the shelves and rearranging them, looking for lines of meaning amid leagues of cacophony and incoherence, reading the history of the past and of the future, collecting our thoughts and collecting the thoughts of others, and every so often, glimpsing mirrors in which we may recognize creatures of the information. Creatures of the information, James Glick.
Thank you all for coming. This is the actual publication date of the book, so this is you're my first audience, and I appreciate your being here. Some of you are friends and family, and I'm glad you turned out. As Andy has just said, it seems especially fitting to me that I should be starting in a library doing this. You've already heard the end of the book. I'm going to read from the beginning of the book. Those of you who know me can attest that during the 8 years or so since I started working on it, I have never quite worked out a simple way of saying what the book was about. The elevator pitch, as they say. It's too big a subject or too vague a subject or something. I just couldn't quite do it. So now I'm finally going to try to answer the question of what the book was about, I hope to your satisfaction. But if not, we'll then have plenty of time for questions. 8 years is a long time. It's long enough that things have really changed during the time I worked on the book. When I started working on it, the initials TMI stood for Three Mile Island, also transmigratory inhibition. I know that because I looked it up in Wikipedia. We begin like this. After 1948, which was the crucial year, people thought they could see the clear purpose that inspired Claude Shannon's work. But that was hindsight. He saw it differently. My mind wanders around, and I conceive of different things day and night. Like a science fiction writer, I'm thinking, what if it were like this? As it happened, 1948 was when the Bell Telephone Laboratories announced the invention of a tiny electronic semiconductor, what they described as an amazingly simple device that could do anything a vacuum tube could do, and more efficiently. It was a crystalline sliver so small that 100 would fit in the palm of a hand. In May, scientists formed a committee to come up with a name, and the committee passed out paper ballots to senior engineers in Murray Hill, New Jersey, listing some choices. Semiconductor triode, iodotron, transistor. That was a hybrid of varistor and transconductance. Transistor won out. Bell Labs declared in a press release, it may have far-reaching significance in electronics and electrical communication. And for once, the reality surpassed the hype. the transistor sparked the revolution in electronics, setting the technology on its path of miniaturization and ubiquity, and soon won the Nobel Prize for its three chief inventors. For the laboratory, it was the jewel in the crown. But it was only the second most significant development of that year. The transistor was only hardware. An invention more profound and more fundamental came in a monograph spread across 79 pages of the Bell System Technical Journal in July and October. No one bothered with a press release. It carried a title both simple and grand, A Mathematical Theory of Communication. And the message was hard to summarize, but it was a fulcrum around which the world began to turn. Like the transistor, this development also involved a neologism, the word bit, chosen in this case not by committee, but by the lone author, a 32-year-old named Claude Shannon. The bit now joined the inch, the pound, the quart, and the minute as a determinate quantity, a fundamental unit of measure. But measuring what? A unit for measuring information, Shannon wrote, as though there were such a thing, measurable and quantifiable, as information. Shannon supposedly belonged to the Bell Labs mathematical research group, but he mostly kept to himself. When the group left the New York headquarters for shiny new space in the New Jersey suburbs, he stayed behind, haunting a cubbyhole in the old building, a 12-story sandy brick hulk on West Street, its industrial back to the Hudson River, its front facing the edge of Greenwich Village. He disliked commuting, and he liked the downtown neighborhood, where he could hear jazz clarinetists in late-night clubs. He was flirting, shyly, with a young woman who worked in Bell Labs' microwave research group in the two-story former Nabisco factory across the street. People considered him a smart young man. Fresh from MIT, he had plunged into the laboratory's war work, first developing an automatic fire control director for anti-aircraft guns, then focusing on the theoretical underpinnings of secret communication, cryptography, and working out a mathematical proof of the security of the so-called X system, the telephone hotline between Winston Churchill and President Roosevelt. So now, his managers were willing to leave him alone, even though they did not understand exactly what he was working on. AT&T at mid-century did not demand instant gratification from its research division. It allowed detours into mathematics or astrophysics with no apparent commercial purpose. Anyway, so much of modern science bore directly or indirectly on the company's mission, which was vast, monopolistic, and almost all-encompassing. Still, broad as it was, the telephone company's core subject matter remained just out of focus. By 1948, more than 125 million conversations passed daily through the Bell System's 138 million miles of cable and 31 million telephone sets. The Bureau of the Census reported these facts under the rubric of communications in the United States, but they were crude measures of communications. The Census also counted several thousand broadcasting stations for radio and a few dozen for television, along with newspapers, books, pamphlets, and the mail. The post office counted its letters and parcels, but what exactly did the Bell System carry? Counted in what units? Not conversations, surely, nor words, nor certainly characters. Perhaps it was just electricity. The company's engineers were electrical engineers. Everyone understood that electricity served as a surrogate for sound, the sound of the human voice, waves in the air entering the telephone mouthpiece and converted into electrical waveforms. This conversion was the essence of the telephone's advance over the telegraph, the predecessor technology already seeming so quaint. Telegraphy relied on a different sort of conversion, a code of dots and dashes, not based on sounds at all, but on the written alphabet, which was, after all, a code in its turn. Indeed, considering the matter closely, one could see a chain of abstraction and conversion, the dots and dashes representing letters of the alphabet, the letters representing sounds and in combination forming words, the words representing some ultimate substrate of meaning, perhaps best left to philosophers. The Bell system had none of those. But the company had hired its first mathematician in 1897, George Campbell, a Minnesotan who had studied in Vienna. He immediately confronted a crippling problem of early telephone transmission. Signals were distorted as they passed across the circuits. The greater the distance, the worse the distortion. Campbell's solution was partly mathematics and partly electrical engineering. His employers learned not to worry much about the distinction. Shannon himself, as a student, had never been able quite to decide whether to become an engineer or a mathematician. For Bell Labs, he was both, willy-nilly, practical about circuits and relays, but happiest in a realm of symbolic abstraction. Most computer engineers focused their expertise on physical problems, amplification and modulation, phase distortion, and signal-to-noise degradation. Shannon liked games and puzzles, secret codes, and tranced him. Beginning when he was a boy, reading Edgar Allan Poe, he gathered threads like a magpie. As a first-year research assistant at MIT, he worked on a 100-ton proto-computer, Vannevar Bush's differential analyzer, which could solve equations with great rotating gears, shafts, and wheels. At 22, he wrote a dissertation that applied a 19th-century idea, George Boole's Algebra of Logic, to the design of electrical circuits. Logic and electricity, a peculiar combination. Later, he worked with the mathematician and logician Hermann Weyl, who taught him what a theory was. Weyl wrote, "Theories permit consciousness to jump over its own shadow, to leave behind the given, to represent the transcendent, yet, as is self-evident, only in symbols." In 1943, the English mathematician and codebreaker, Alan Turing, visited Bell Labs on a cryptographic mission and met Shannon, sometimes over lunch, where they traded speculation on the future of artificial thinking machines. "Shannon wants to feed not just data to a brain, but cultural things," Turing exclaimed. "He wants to play music to it." Shannon also crossed paths with Norbert Wiener, who had taught him at MIT, and by 1948 was proposing a new discipline to be called cybernetics, the study of communication and control. Meanwhile, Shannon began paying special attention to television signals, from a peculiar point of view, wondering whether their content could somehow be compacted or compressed to allow for faster transmission. Logic and circuits crossbred to make a new hybrid thing. So did codes and genes. In his solitary way, seeking a framework to connect his many threads, Shannon began assembling a theory for information. The raw material lay all around, glistening and buzzing in the landscape of the early 20th century, letters and messages, sounds and images, news and instructions, figures and facts, signals and signs, a hodgepodge of related species. They were on the move by post or wire or electromagnetic wave, but no one word denoted all that stuff. "Off and on," Shannon wrote to Vannevar Bush at MIT in 1939, "I have been working on an analysis of some of the fundamental properties of general systems for the transmission of intelligence. Intelligence, that was a flexible term, very old. Now used for an elegant word, Sir Thomas Eliot wrote in the 16th century, where there is mutual treaties or appointments, either by letters or message. It had taken on other meanings, though. A few engineers, especially in the telephone labs, began speaking of information. They used the word in a way suggesting something technical, quantity of information, or measure of information. Shannon adopted this usage. For the purposes of science, information had to mean something special. 3 centuries earlier, the new discipline of physics could not proceed until Isaac Newton appropriated words that were ancient and vague: force, mass, motion, and even time, and gave them new meanings. Newton made these terms into quantities suitable for use in mathematical formulas. Until then, motion, for example, had been just as soft and inclusive a term as information. For as Aristotelians, motion covered a far-flung family of phenomena: a peach ripening, a stone falling, a child growing, a body decaying. That was too rich. Most varieties of motion had to be tossed out before Newton's laws could apply, and the scientific revolution could succeed. In the 19th century, energy began to undergo a similar transformation. Natural philosophers adapted a word meaning vigor or intensity. They mathematicized it, giving energy its fundamental place in the physicist's view of nature. Now it was the same with information. A rite of purification became necessary. And then, when it was made simple, distilled, counted in bits, information was found to be everywhere. Shannon's theory made a bridge between information and uncertainty, between information and entropy, and between information and chaos. It led to compact disks and fax machines, computers and cyberspace, Moore's Law, and all the world's Silicon Alleys. Information processing was born, along with information storage and information retrieval. People began to name a successor to the Iron Age and the Steam Age. Marshall McLuhan remarked in 1967, "Man, the food gatherer, reappears incongruously as information gatherer." We can see now that information is what our world runs on, the blood and the fuel, the vital principle. It pervades the sciences from top to bottom, transforming every branch of knowledge. Information theory began as a bridge from mathematics to electrical engineering and from there to computing. Now even biology has become an information science, a subject of messages, instructions, and codes. The information circle becomes the unit of life, says Werner Lowenstein, after 30 years spent studying intercellular communication. He reminds us that information means something deeper now. It connotes a cosmic principle of organization and order, and it provides an exact measure of that. The gene has a cultural analog, too, the meme. In cultural evolution, a meme is a replicator and propagator: an idea, a fashion, a chain letter, or a conspiracy theory. On a bad day, a meme is a virus. And atoms? Matter has its own coinage, and the hardest science of all, physics, seemed to have reached maturity. But physics, too, finds itself sideswiped by a new intellectual model. In the years after World War II, the heyday of the physicists, the great news of science appeared to be the splitting of the atom and the control of nuclear energy. Theorists focused their prestige and resources on the search for fundamental particles and the laws governing their interaction. From this exalted enterprise, the business of communications research could not have appeared further removed. At Bell Labs, Claude Shannon was not thinking about physics. Particle physicists did not need bits. And then, all at once, they did. Increasingly, the physicists and the information theorists are one and the same. The bit is a fundamental particle of a different sort, not just tiny, but abstract, a binary digit, a flip-flop, a yes or no. It is insubstantial, yet as scientists finally come to understand information, they wonder whether it may be primary, more fundamental than matter itself. They suggest that the bit is the irreducible kernel, and that information forms the very core of existence. Now, as the role of information grows beyond anyone's reckoning, it grows to be too much. TMI, people now say. We have information fatigue, anxiety, and glut. We have met the devil of information overload and his impish underlings, the computer virus, the busy signal, the dead link, and the PowerPoint presentation. All this, too, is due in its roundabout way to Shannon. Everything changed so quickly. John Robertson Pierce, the Bell Labs engineer who had come up with the word transistor, mused afterward, "It is hard to picture the world before Shannon as it seemed to those who lived in it. It is difficult to recover innocence, ignorance, and lack of understanding." Yet the past does come back into focus. "In the beginning was the word," according to John. "We are the species that named itself Homo sapiens, the one who knows," and then, after reflection, amended that to Homo sapiens sapiens. The greatest gift of Prometheus to humanity was not fire, after all. Numbers, too, chiefest of sciences I invented for them, and the combining of letters, creative mother of the muses' arts, with which to hold all things in memory. The alphabet was a founding technology of information. The telephone, the fax machine, the calculator, and ultimately the computer are only the latest innovations devised for saving, manipulating, and communicating knowledge. Our culture has absorbed a working vocabulary for these useful inventions. We speak of compressing data, aware that this is quite different from compressing a gas. We know about streaming information, parsing it, sorting it, matching it, and filtering it. Our furniture includes iPads and plasma displays. Our skills include texting and Googling. We are endowed. We are experts. So we see information in the foreground. But it has always been there. It pervaded our ancestors' world, too, taking forms from solid to ethereal, granite gravestones and the whispers of courtiers, the punched card, the cash register, the 19th century difference engine, the wires of telegraphy, all played their parts in weaving the spider web of information to which we cling. Each new information technology in its own time set off blooms in storage and transmission. From the printing press came new species of information organizers, dictionaries, cyclopedias, almanacs, compendiums of words, classifiers of facts, trees of knowledge. Hardly any information technology goes obsolete. Each new one throws its predecessors into relief. Thus Thomas Hobbes, in the 17th century, resisted his era's new media hype. He wrote, "The invention of printing, though ingenious, compared with the invention of letters, is no great matter." Up to a point, he was right. Every new medium transforms the nature of human thought. In the long run, History is the story of information becoming aware of itself. Thank you. I think that's enough reading. I'll be very happy to answer any questions that people have. I think Andy has a plan.
It's a simple plan. Raise your hand. We'll get a microphone to you. One question per person, please. We've got a good crowd tonight. Who would like to start us off? Well, Jim, thanks for coming this evening. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you all.
People, right in the front row here, right in the middle. Allison?
So you react to threats.
Since this is such a broad topic, an overwhelming, how did you begin, how did you organize your research?
It is daunting. It was a daunting idea. I did have the feeling all along that it's sort of embarrassing feeling that I was trying to write the history of everything. To organize it, though, I did think right from the beginning to start the way you just heard me start, with in the middle of the story in 1948, because that's when Claude Shannon invented what mathematicians and scientists now call information theory. So that seemed like a starting point, even though it was in the middle. And from there, I leap back to the beginning of history and tell some of the stories of earlier information technologies in the new light of how we now understand information. Then we get back up toward the present, and then I try to deal a little bit with our current predicament, which is the flood of my subtitle. The subtitle is, it's hard to read on this jacket, but it's A History, a Theory, a Flood. So that was sort of my plan for organizing it. I don't know how well I succeeded, but it's a plan anyway.
Another question right here.
I'm not sure how to frame this, but there's an argument among mathematicians whether mathematics is invented or discovered. And so information seems to be embodied and necessarily discovered, but then you just use the word invention to describe Claude Shannon. I was wondering if you wrestled with that dichotomy as you thought through the book.
Yeah, I love that question. Did everybody get that? You know, mathematicians will say when they discover some theorem, or what would a mathematician discover, that they discovered it as opposed to inventing it. It wasn't something they created. It was something that was there all along waiting to be discovered. And that's exactly true of information. And in fact, information is sort of the fundamental way of thinking about that exact conundrum. The things that mathematicians discover, if we say that they were there all along, we're giving a kind of primacy to information as a thing that can exist independent of us mere humans. I mean, you could say that information is completely dependent on humans. You could define information as what passes from one human to another, or you can say that information is something that existed all along, with or without us. And it's this second view that is a little more in tune with the way scientists, at least, think of information now. So is that an answer to your question? Maybe not so much. Oh, no.
Gentlemen, on our left.
So I know you'll know the topic because you wrote the book, but Richard Feynman, who's my hero of my life, I know you remember the Nova special that he was in when he's sitting in the chair and he's sitting in his own easy chair and he's talking about all the information that's passing through us all the time and we're only able to gather this tiny, tiny bit. And I wonder what your response would be to that with regard, you know, he's breaking down the electromagnetic spectrum into this little tiny slice that we can see and hear and perceive. And there's all this other information that he is in awe and wonder of. And I wonder how you compare that to the information that you've been talking about here.
Well, I love that idea, and to be honest, I'd completely forgotten that. Feynman does make a couple of cameo appearances in this book, but I'd forgotten that Nova Special, and I'd forgotten his saying that, and if he said that early, it sort of shows, once again, that he was a little bit ahead of the curve. That is, of people thinking of the stuff impinging on them, physicists thinking of the stuff impinging on them, not just as matter and energy, but as information. But of course, the way you've put it, it's a nice metaphor for the way a lot of us feel these days about our situation, that there's a lot of real information, not electromagnetic information from the sun and stars, but you know, stuff from Twitter and Facebook and TV and too many books flowing over us every day, and that it's increasingly a challenge for us to find the stuff that's important and select the stuff that we need. All of this becomes a big subject of the book.
How about you, Rose Peck?
In your answer to a previous question, you talked about information passing from one human to another. And it occurred to me that we're able to, with our own bodies, learn how to translate clay tablets, Dead Sea Scrolls, books and languages that are thousands of years old. But in the future, information that's being developed today will require something more than our own bodies and our own skills to be able to translate into knowledge, personal knowledge, because information is being encoded electronically, and it all now requires a device of some kind to translate it back into things that we can deal with. Just want to comment about that from you.
This is a very good audience, may I just say? I do want to comment on that. Let me just think for a second. Before we had to learn to translate clay tablets, even clay tablets from thousands of years before us, whose secrets have been forgotten, we had to learn to put stuff down onto those clay tablets. And we're basically the same organisms doing that. So you would think that we would have the ability one way or another to reverse the process, to reverse engineer the clay tablets. I'm not sure I accept the presumption that people or other or alien species in future times will not be able to figure out the messages that we have encoded in microscopic laser-embedded pits on silicon, or in all the other electronic formats that we use for storing information, all smaller and smaller. It's true that we need intermediaries. We need some technology, but we use technology to put the information down there in the first place. And so maybe the need for these hypothetical descendants of ours to use electron microscopes to figure out how to read a CD is not all that different from our need to decipher cuneiform or whatever. You're expressing a worry that's very common and very genuine about at least I think you're expressing this, what is the real stability, what's the status of all of the vast amounts of information that we think we're preserving in various media today, when these media have a tendency to go obsolete very quickly, and, as you say, to depend on various forms of technology that may not be here. It's a tough question. I tend to be sort of optimistic about it, just because I think sometimes we forget how much of what was written down in the past is irrevocably lost to us. You know, all of the plays of Sophocles. People knew how to read them, but they didn't save them. It's also a problem, and I describe this a little at one point in the book, that came up in an amusing way not that long ago in our lifetimes when they sent the Voyager satellites, passed out through the solar system. And when they sent those satellites out, not satellites, little spaceship, and their principal mission was to beam back pictures of the planets to Earth. But after that job was done, the scientists knew that these little spacecraft were going to go onward forever. And so somebody, Carl Sagan and friends, had the whimsical idea of putting a message in the bottle, as it were. Some of you may remember this. And they put together sounds of Earth on a phonograph record, a technology that has since gone obsolete. How many of you here have the ability, if you need to play a vinyl phonograph record? Okay. All right. So even obsolete technology never vanishes. But and this particular phonograph record was engraved in gold, not vinyl. And they put it on the spaceship, and they put on board. And this really shows how silly the whole venture is, in a way. A needle, a cartridge, but not a turntable. And not a source of electrical power. And they put some kind of instructions in the form of drawings in the hopes that whatever alien race would get this phonograph record would be able to figure it out. Well, it's not ridiculous, and in a way, you might think the phonograph record is closer to the cuneiform tablets than to our silicon forms of storing memory, of storing information, because at least if you can see the grooves, you can see the sound waves in analog form, and maybe they could figure it out. That was a long answer.
Back on our right about Nate Munoz.
Yeah. In the last year, there's been some work on gravity trying to explain it in terms of information. That, for instance, the area of a black hole is exactly proportionate to the amount of information inside the black hole. Do you have any comment on that?
I'm only going to punt a little bit by saying that there have been some information controversies involving black holes. There was a famous one that involved Stephen Hawking and a bet, and I write about this in the book a little bit. I'm not going to try to summarize it now, not because I think that you wouldn't understand it, but because it's over my head. This is one of the areas of physics, the study of black holes, that has been quite significantly transformed by thinking in terms of information and not just in terms of matter and energy.
Right here in the second row, and then we'll go all the way back.
So I don't know if you deal with this in the book, but all of this is this paradigm shift and changes. What do you think are the implications for education, for educating kids for the future? What do we need to do differently?
I'm a believer in something that I don't really think needs that much help from us, and that is making sure that kids are digitally fluent, that they speak this new language. The reason they don't need much help from us is obvious. Their kids tend to get onto new technologies faster than their parents did. I mean, it's more likely that people in this room learned what they know about how to use computers from their children than from their parents. There's some controversy, I guess, about whether computers belong in classrooms. There's certainly reason to worry about the disappearance of old values and the use of computers as game machines and video monitors, but by and large, I think sophistication about information technology is necessary to people now and ought to be a part of education.
Gentlemen, all the way in the Back in the middle there.
Where does Watson and its children and grandchildren fit into the picture that you're posing in the future? The IBM Watson that...
the Watson machine?
Yeah, that was on...
That just was on Jeopardy?
Yes.
For a second, I thought maybe you were asking me about James Watson and...
Sorry.
And Francis Crick, but I guess he's obsolete now. Watson is now... well, there are things to say about that. The whole business with Watson on Jeopardy and the little flurry of discussion about whether or not you could say that this meant finally machines were thinking, machines were truly intelligent, machines were more or less like humans. This is a conversation that I think we all started having with ourselves right at the dawn of the period of information theory that was set off by the work in 1948 that I started by describing. Soon after that, computers really were arriving on the scene, and they were on the cover of Time magazine and Life magazine. And this question, can machines think, became a question that really stirred the popular imagination even more vividly than it did in the past few weeks with this Jeopardy program, believe it or not. And a lot of the discussion was exactly the same then, 40 years ago, 50 years ago, as it was in the last few weeks. And it's not a question that can be answered now. I don't know if you're asking me to make a prediction about whether... what's the expression about our new overlords? Whether they'll be taking over, I don't have any predictions like that, except I do have a prejudice, which is that machines can think because we're kind of machines. Understanding the processes of our own thought is a problem of understanding information processing. Computers have things to teach us about information. I mentioned a little bit earlier that we have a tendency now to be willing to think of information as something that exists independently of humans. That's partly because we know that information can be passed not just from our minds to other minds, but from one computer to another. And we know that that's the same stuff. It's not exactly the same as knowledge, and knowledge is not the same as wisdom. That's... I'm paraphrasing T.S. Eliot now, and it's important for us to remember that. But still, just as a point of personal prejudice, I'm on the side of people who think that there isn't, in the long run, any fundamental difference between us and machinery.
Fourth or fifth row here?
Well, so that's the question. There's so much information, there's so much we need to know in order to make decent decisions, that the information overload, I guess what I say is, you know, how do we get the help we need?
I have two things to say about that in the brief time allotted to me. One is, it's important to be aware, I think, and this is one thing I try to do in the book, that this feeling of information overload is not a new feeling. It's an ancient feeling. All through history, you can see every new information technology bringing complaints of exactly the kind that we make today. There's just too much. Now we have printed books. Too much. How can we possibly keep up with everything? How can we possibly find all the things we need to know? And then there are newspapers, and a lot of what's in the newspapers is garbage. And how do you sort out fact from fiction? Which is not to say that the problems are not real, and it's also not to say that the problems aren't now worse than ever. They are. It almost goes without saying. So how do we solve it? I sort of feel embarrassed to try to give advice, because I think everybody in this room already is finding his or her own solutions. And we're doing it through search, which is why Google is making so much money, and we're doing it by finding various smart forms of filtering the information. Filters can be old-fashioned experts like editors, or they can be technological things. But it's important to think in terms of those two things, I think, search and filtering, sort of opposite sides of the coin of making sense of the deluge.
You know what? No, we're going to skip you because you already asked a question about eight rows back there.
It seems to me that information is changing so quickly, namely the modes in production and storage and everything else, that if I were writing a book, by the time I got finished with, laid out what I was going to write, by the time I got finished with chapter N, there were five more chapters that I had to write. How did you ever bring this to a conclusion?
I knew from the beginning that the book was going to end in the present, whenever that would turn out to be, and it was several years later than it was supposed to be. But I also didn't worry too much about being out of date, because I felt I was just going to deal with this in a way that wasn't going to depend on the thing of the moment. When I started writing the book, there was no such thing as Twitter. Facebook was a gleam in the eyes of the Winklevoss brothers, or whoever you believe invented it. Now we have those things, and sort of in the last months of writing the book, I was putting things in that seemed extremely topical, but not inserting them, you know, as like sprinkles on the chocolate sundae, trying to make sense of them in the narrative. And since I've delivered the manuscript, which was almost a year ago, I have had to see things in the paper every day and think to myself, gee, I wish I could say something about that. I do have a blog. But the book is what it is. And if it is out of date, then it's out of date, and it will have to stand as an artifact of 2011, which a year from now will seem like the ancient past.
We have time for just a couple more questions. About six rows back here, a gentleman in the brown or plaid hand up. I'll tell you what, and then pass the mic to the gentleman.
Did Shannon and his kind of generation of information theorists, did they have any sort of moral imperative, or at least any conception of the kind of moral implications to opening up access to information so vastly?
I don't think Shannon did, no. Shannon in particular, he was a fascinating man, and I wish I had had the chance to meet him. I never did. But he was... he liked solving puzzles. He liked the intellectual play. He thought he was doing something important, and he did think about the information revolution in human terms. But I don't think you could say that he was motivated by any desire to be an educator or to help people communicate with one another. He didn't have a vision of, I don't know what you would say, the internet setting people free or anything like that. These moral questions are, I think these moral questions are very real, and they're for us to worry about. And by the way, the fact that Shannon didn't doesn't mean that some of his colleagues and contemporaries didn't. I think people did in different degrees. Norbert Wiener, for example, is someone who very much was always thinking about humanistic principles in a way that Shannon wasn't. So I guess I would say scientists vary.
Since we're in a library, I wonder if you could look a little bit in the future and thinking about projects that Google has of digitizing books and so forth, what do you predict will be the library of the future?
Will they exist? I think we can already see what the library of the future is now. At the risk of offending our hosts, it feels as though the library of the future is going to be a virtual thing and is not going to depend so much on buildings. That doesn't mean that today's libraries and librarians will go obsolete. I've said, I think twice already, that I don't think information technologies ever go obsolete. But I think some vision of a universal library is already taking shape before our eyes. As you said, Google has begun digitizing all of the books in the world, and you can start to see online the fruits of their labors. I made a lot of use of Google Books in researching this book, and was able to gather a lot of information on my computer that would in the past have required long trips to physical libraries and many more hours. Those libraries had to be there and they have to stay there, but a new kind of library is already taking shape.
Yeah, I would also say, just working here, that a lot of people come here to have librarians sort of find what they need still and act as filters for this deluge of information that has come our way. We've got time for one more question. Gentleman right there on the aisle.
You're aware that Shannon was a great juggler, but two things that he didn't actually juggle were the contents and what is transmitted, which is what he called information. But what he did not address, what he explicitly excluded, was semantics. I wonder if you discuss semantics in the book.
Yeah, this is a pretty good last question. I don't think I use the word semantics in the book at all, and I hope that by saying that I can sell a few extra copies. But as you're pointing out, Shannon explicitly excluded from his definition of information any notion of meaning. He said the bits that he was telling engineers how to count and writing equations about were completely independent of any human sense of whether the underlying message was true or false or even nonsense. Same number of bits. He was completely explicit about it. And the science of information theory that emerged was a science that disregarded the meaning of the message. The problem for us is we live in a time when meaning is what we care about. And all of the concern that people have talked about tonight of being overwhelmed by a barrage of bits, most of which is meaningless, is echoed by, and not accidentally, by this fairly inhuman kind of information science, a science that talks about information divorced from meaning. The problem for us, and it's a problem that I try to address in my epilogue, is how to bring meaning back into the picture.
You can find out by reading the information. The James Glick. Thank you.
Thank you all very much.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.